Do you know what time it is? It's supernatural story time. And if you're easily scared, and even if you're not, there's only one thing left to do. Just turn off the lights, because these are stories that you listen to only in the dark.
Cemetery Stories, Volume 3. Story number 1. When I was a little kid, my dad gave me an old cigar box that belonged to my grandfather. My dad didn't know what was in it, despite having kept it for years. Grandpa gave him strict orders never to peek. I never knew my grandpa. He passed away when I was a baby, but my dad loved him dearly. We never had much in the way of things, but he always had a smile for his family, my dad said, which I interpreted as both a remembrance and as a warning not to expect anything too fancy under the lid. The box itself was decorated with a colorful circus scene full of exotic animals and balancing clowns. The ringmaster stood in the foreground, clutching a cigar in his teeth. Sir Flanagan's Fine Cigars, said the logo, for a pure healthy smoke every time. I snapped off the brittle rubber band that held the lid on for those years and lifted. My father need not have worried I'd be disappointed. The small quirky treasures I found inside thrilled me, no matter their material value. The first thing I saw was the scowl of a little wooden demon god from some exotic faraway island. Clinking near it were several coins of haughty monarchs gazing outward. Underneath them were several yellowing worn pages covered in strange hieroglyphics. I lifted these up and saw a bracelet of twine fitted with teeth from a shark, a tiger, a man. There was a lock of boar's hair and an onyx marble, a passenger ticket to Siam. From my grandpa's time in World War II was a brass rifle cartridge. Its significance left for me to ponder. On the bottom of the box sat four photo booth pictures of my grandfather, looking exactly like my dad, mugging for the camera in what had to have been one of the few carefree moments of his life. I put the box on my bed, and when I turned to look for a magnifying glass, it slipped down to the floor. That's when the letter popped out. It was hidden under the bottom panel of the box, several pages covered in scratchy handwriting. I laid next to my bedside lamp and began to read. Dear Ben, as I write this, I'm lying in an old Veterans Affairs hospital with an IV in my one good arm and a catheter up the old battle rifle. They say they're doing everything they can to keep me comfortable, but if that were true, they'd let me smoke a damn cigarette. At least they cut down the morphine enough for me to stay awake and write this. What I have to tell you is important. So, how are you? I saw you for the very first time last week, and you didn't look too happy. Cute, sure, but you seemed very angry at everything. Turns out you had some poop in your diaper. We have a lot in common already. I gotta be honest. Life isn't going to be easy. It certainly wasn't for me. Me, your dad, and your grandma had some tough times growing up. Lots of times. All we had was each other. But things are going to be different for you. How so? Well, let me start at the beginning. Back in the middle of the Great Depression, I was a 16-year-old high school dropout. That wasn't so unusual. A lot of teenagers were dropping out of school to try and support their families. I wish I could say that was my motivation, but I just didn't like the teachers. I spent my days with the other neighborhood scraps. We called ourselves the Runaround Gang. We'd break shop windows, rob apple carts, snatch hats off trolley riders. My parents did their best to rein me in, but they had their hands full with five other kids. I was a lost cause. Then one day, they couldn't ignore me anymore. I got arrested for swiping a pricey necklace from an uptown department store. This was a step up from our usual petty misadventures, which is why I did it. I wanted to impress the other boys in the gang. Well, they were impressed all right. They cheered and screamed my name out for all to hear as they watched the squad car take me away. The cops called my dad at work. He was a day laborer, so not only did he have to pony up bail, he also lost half the day's wages. "I'll let you stay in there if it weren't for your mom," he said. "You really broke our heart this time." Hearing that killed me. My mother was a sweet woman. "Oh, Jimmy," she said when we got home, "I'm sorry we haven't been there for you. We've been too busy to see our little boy needed help." She dabbed her cheeks with a handkerchief. I would have preferred a smack on the head. I didn't want her to feel guilty. I decided right then and there I was going to make her proud of me. "There's a cargo ship leaving next week," I stuttered. "I signed up for it. I'll be gone 3 months, but it's good money when I get back." My parents looked at each other confused. Then my dad said, "You'd better not be bullshitting us." I was, in a way. I hadn't signed up for any ship, but I really did want to. As luck would have it, I found one the next day that needed workers. I was surprised they hired on a young fool like myself, until they told me how much I'd earn. It was slave wages, but it would help. The ship was leaving in a week. In the meantime, I did my best to stay out of trouble. I had a court date soon, and I wanted to be able to plead for leniency. Truth be told, if it weren't for my family, I would have skipped it, got on the ship, and disappeared to some faraway land. Things would have turned out a lot differently then for both you and me. My day in court arrived. The judge was a crusty old windbag who sweated hatred from every pore. From the second he laid his glass eye on me, I knew I was in trouble. "You claim you're trying to right your life and help your family," he said. "But you wasn't stealing food. You had a big old fancy lady's bracelet in your pocket when you was apprehended." "Maybe he wanted to get his mob presence," said the bailiff. The judge laughed. "Well, I'll be honest. You don't seem like the worst in the world. Hell, maybe you just fell into the wrong crowd. So I'm going to be lenient." I had my head down, ashamed, but raised it when he said that. "Your Honor, I appreciate it. I promise I'm going to turn my life around." "Don't give me that crap," he said. "There ain't 10,000 words equal to a single good deed. If you're truly committed to making your life one that respects the rule of law, then you'll commit to atoning for breaking that rule to which you've suddenly professed your loyalty. So, I promise, it's not going to cut it today, boy. Therefore, I'm sentencing you to one night volunteering at the Ezekiel K. Renfield Public Library. It's a fine institution, but one in dire need of a good dusting and organizing, which you will provide as part of your turnaround towards a righteous life. Understand? Good." He pounded his gavel. I told you he was a windbag, didn't I? It took me a minute to mentally sift through all that yakking. He didn't realize what my sentence was. A night cleaning in the library? Hell, that was nothing. To be honest, I'd never actually been in a library. But still, I wasn't worried. All I had to do was push dust under some rugs and I'd be home free. The Ezekiel K. Renfield Public Library had stone columns and gargoyles and looked like the villain's mansion in a detective movie. My goody two-shoe siblings or any of the other smart kids who actually picked up a book every now and then never went there. They went to the library downtown instead. So why was this old bee still around? Who knows? Ezekiel Renfield, wherever he was, must have left quite a grant for it to sit there and collect dust. Maybe it's where the judge used to study for his law exams 100 years ago. I walked up the stairs and found a tired-looking security guard watching me on the far side of the glass. He pushed open the door, asked me what I wanted, and let me inside once I mentioned the judge. I walked inside and heard the door shut behind me. The security guard was now outside and about to head down the steps. "Hey!" I hollered out to him. "Aren't you sticking around?" "You joking with me, kid?" he said. "They don't need a security guard during the day, much less at night. You afraid of some books?" He trotted down the stairs without waiting for a reply. "Okay, great." I had a place to myself. I let out a woo and looked around. I was standing on a dark red carpet worn down to threads on the walkway. There were a few desks with chairs, and all along the walls were freestanding bookshelves. There were no electric lights, just a huge window high up on the wall. The mezzanine loomed above, the staircase to my left. There looked to be a few more tables and bookshelves up there, as well as a green bronze statue of a man resting his hand on a sword hilt while he gazed out the giant window. "Well, hell," I thought, "this place is huge." I didn't know where to start. I found the janitor's closet, pulled out a broom, and began to sweep. Within minutes, I had a pile of dirt big enough to jump on. I scooped it up, dumped it in a can, and swiped a cloth across one of the tables. A snowfall of dust fell onto the freshly swept floor. Maybe housekeeping wasn't my forte. I decided to take a break, having been on the job for all of 10 minutes. I strolled through the shelves, looking at the occasional book spine. I've never been much of a reader, unless you count comic books. Still, I thought there might be a science fiction novel for me to waste some time with, hopefully with pictures, but I had no such luck. Instead, I had trouble even reading the titles. Of recruiting the lewd and lowborn for tasks unseemly, how to killeth the bothersome, the book of the unseen half, encyclopedia of spiritual deformities, and so on. I finally found what I liked and tucked it into the back of my jeans for later. Then another one caught my eye. It was on a top shelf, red and thick as a Bible. I pulled it out and almost dropped it on my head. It was so heavy. The title was Her Majesty's Reckoning. Lucky me. This one actually had pictures, but they weren't the type of illustrations I usually enjoyed. The first one was a woodcut of a man smiling while he set himself on fire. The one after that showed a bunch of little figurines tie someone down in his bed and stab him. Yikes. Mosquito Man versus Super Cat. This was not. I tried to put the book back, but it slipped out of my hands and thumped to the floor. That's when I heard it, a long shh coming from the other side of the room. I froze and listened for it again. Nothing. I walked out from between the shelves and called out, "Hello?" No response. I looked up at the mezzanine. The statue looked straight ahead, arrogant. Clouds hid the moon through the window behind it. "Is anyone here?" I said. "Shh." This time, it was more forceful. I squinted and tried to see in the darkness between two of the bookshelves. There was another statue there. It was a man with a powdered wig like the kind George Washington and all those guys used to wear. Then the clouds moved on, and moonlight shone down. It wasn't a statue. It was a real man, only his face didn't have skin on it. It was just a bunch of veins and muscles with lidless eyes and lipless teeth. I tripped over my own feet going backwards. I looked up from the ground and the man was gone. What happened to you?" I said. "Are you okay?" Something scraped the floor behind me. I spun around to see a girl about my size, turned around and sliding backwards, while dragging her heels on the marble. The back of her head was braided up into two ponytails. She wore an old green dress that was tattered and dirty. She flexed her hand open and shut as she came towards me. Suddenly she started barking, jerking her head forward as she did so. Rah, rah, rah. It looked like she was doing it to the shelves, since that's where she was facing. But I knew it was meant for me. She was only a few feet away now. I still couldn't see her face, but I could see spittle flying from her mouth as her barking grew more and more vicious. That was plenty enough for me. I ran towards the door, expecting it to be locked, but it flew right open. I ran all the way home. My dad was still awake. I could tell he was about to lay into me, but then he saw the look on my face. He just shook his head and muttered, "Well, I guess you're alive." I was, but that was about the extent of the good news. I hung my head and shuffled off to bed. I let a few weird statues and some barking prankster scare me away. Now I wouldn't be able to leave on that ship. The only place I was headed was jail, once that judge heard about what happened. He didn't do it, though. In fact, I'm not sure he even remembered me. I sat in the galley with about 20 other miscreants and scurried in front of him when my name was called. He read over my statement, shrugged, and told me to be on my way. "Hope you learned your lesson," he said without looking up, then called out for the next defendant. Well, I wish that was the end of my story, but it wasn't. Later that night, after a dinner of beans and biscuits, I sat up in the attic studying. Yes, that's right, studying. My experience in the library notwithstanding, I was beginning to realize the importance of education. I took a break to lean against the wall and stare out the round attic window. The streets were quiet and the lights in all the houses were dim. Then I saw her, the barking girl from the library. She was still turned around and I couldn't see her face. I almost grabbed the hammer or anything else for a weapon, but thought better of it. I knew what she was there for. I went down the stairs and snuck past my parents in the den. I jogged down the street. The girl was gone, but then I heard a single sharp bark behind me. She was within arm's reach. I could see the back of her neck now. It was reddish and raw, like there'd been a rope tied around it. She wasn't barking, but I could hear her rattled breathing, like her lungs were full of rocks. I held out the book I'd taken from the library. The girl stretched her arm back behind her. It was an awkward angle, but she snatched the book with ease and brought it back in front of her. Then she began to turn her head to the side. Very slowly, but just before I could see her profile, she jerked her head back and sprinted off into the darkness. So, my lovely grandson, that was without a doubt the most formative experience in my life. In case you're wondering, I did make it onto that cargo ship. It was a rat-filled, seasick-inducing yuck-fest of a journey, but at least I got paid. Not long after that, I got drafted into the army. Luckily, I was never in actual combat, though I lost a few friends that were. I met your grandma when I got out. I tried hard to give her and your dad a good life, but it wasn't all I could do. I had restrictions. You're probably wondering what the hell I mean. If you found this letter, then you will. Love you, kid, and remember, don't shoplift, Grandpa. At the time, I didn't quite know what to make of it except that it was an entertaining story. The lines at the end about restrictions baffled me, though. That's when I took a closer look at the folded yellow pieces of paper sitting innocuously in the cigar box, the ones marked with strange hieroglyphics. It took me years to decipher them all, but when I did, I nearly fainted at the magnitude of my discovery. Apparently, my grandfather had torn some pieces out of the book he'd taken from the library. A gutsy move, to be sure. And had the Wraith discovered his trickery, I wouldn't exist today, but she didn't. The rules the papers described were very clear. Whoever finds these spells curses himself if he uses them, as well as his child. But the child of his child, he can use them all he wants. One of the idiosyncrasies of magic, I suppose. The book's title, as written on the top margin, was Spells for Luck at Games of Chance. I thought it sounded downright silly. After I'd won the lottery twice in a row, I began to think otherwise. I'll never forget how hard my grandfather worked to give me this advantage, and I also keep in mind the kindness and love he showed his own family, even though his bank account really reached 4 digits. I do spend a lot of money on myself, I'll admit. I like the nicer things in life, but I also make sure I give to charity, including a very generous yearly gift to the Ezekiel K. Renfield Public Library. Story number 2. A lot of small towns have creepy, weird local rituals you do as kids. Some have you sit alone in a cemetery all night, ding-dong ditch a notoriously crotchety neighbor, or fiddle around with a Ouija board to connect with the spirit of someone of significance to the town or school. In my town, we have Holly House. Past the old dairy on Farmstead Road and up to Dirt Road, there is an old brick mansion from the early 1800s. It's an awesome-looking building in the daylight. However, at night, your imagination transforms it into a thing from your worst nightmares. Decorative window fixtures become wide, angry eyes, and the crumbling front steps paired with the shards of wood that was once a door become a gruesome, sharp-toothed mouth. On a full moon, the house draws on the appearance of a great, big, grinning monster, ready to gobble up stupid teenagers who dare to enter. Local lore dictates that the seniors who completed Holly House in their first year tag an incoming freshman to do the same. The ritual of Holly House has always been a closely guarded secret. Unless you attempted it, you didn't know what it really was. That kind of is what made it cool. A week prior to the first full moon of autumn, Justin Thorpe tagged me in Spanish class. While he was passing back our last quiz, he handed me my paper and a red envelope with my name on the front in ornate letters. I admit, I thought it was a very different kind of letter, but, well, you know, live and let live. Though he did spell my name wrong. Phoebe Mitchell and Taryn Davis were also tagged. I learned later. In our letters were instructions to dress warm and bring the following. A flashlight, a doll, a red ribbon, white chalk, a quarter. And the strangest of all was the last page torn from the Castle of Otranto by Horace Walpole. Not just the last page in the book, the last page with actual text from the story. I went to the school library and the local library, and when I asked for the copy of the Castle of Otranto, I got the stink eye. I don't suppose they took kindly to kids tearing pages from books. I finally found a copy in a used bookstore. The night after I was tagged, I went home and asked my cousin Mary about her experience doing Holly House. It was really dark, she said, so bring a good flashlight. Hell, I'd grab that headlamp your brother had. That way you have both your arms. That caught my attention. Adam did Holly House? I asked, feeling a strange sense of elation. Yep, the year after I did. I tried to think of a question to ask, something about Adam, but I found it hard to form words behind the growing lump in my throat It still hurt to even mention his name. "But what was it like?" I asked and said. "What do you do?" She grinned at me, a strange sort of sparkle in her eyes. "Nuh-uh. That'd be telling, and it's against the rules." Ugh, rules. Like Fight Club. The first rule of Holly House is don't talk about Holly House. Or at least, what it is you actually have to do. Everyone talks about doing Holly House, just not what it entails. It's both enthralling, terrifying, and exacerbating all at the same time. Adam never mentioned doing Holly House, at least to me, though we hadn't really been on the best of terms the last year before the accident. "Oh, and make sure to wear red," my cousin added. "I have a hoodie you can borrow." "Why?" "You'll find out. Plus, you've been wearing too much black." All that week, before I was to do it, my whole attitude shifted. Before, I thought Holly House was a stupid, inane thing that the seniors liked to do to mess with the younger students. A day of pranking where they could drink booze, grope each other, and laugh at the freshmen peeing their pants in fright. Because for some reason, that's what I imagine seniors like to do. But suddenly, after Justin tagged me, and hearing that Adam had been tagged too, I wanted it. I wanted to beat Holly House. I wanted to experience all what Adam might have experienced the night he did it. And if Justin Thorpe decided I was cool and maybe we should start hanging out and maybe go out sometime, well, that would be awesome too. The full moon landed on a Friday. Mary dropped me off at the dirt road and handed me her promised red hoodie. It was a bit cool, so I took it. She wished me luck before driving off into the night. With my pockets filled with my required offerings, I made my way up to the house. The road seemed well maintained for a path that led to a supposed haunted house. There were fresh tire tracks and a sheet of plywood laying over gravel covering a dip in the road. It wasn't too bad of a walk with Adam's headlamp, but the slight incline left me a little breathless when I finally got into viewing range. It was a beast of a building. The moonlight filtered into the back of the house, making the front windows glow. 2 stories high with a stone-rimmed roof, guarded by sour-faced gargoyles in various states of decay. The house stood like a monolith to a bygone era of unimaginable wealth. It was one of the last great estates left in this area, and there was a palpable sadness to it, like a missed opportunity to preserve something so connected to our town's identity. A light breeze sent shivers through the overgrowth and trees. For such a deathly silent place, it felt eerily alive in the moonlight. A small green hatchback and a blotted blue Taurus were parked away from the building near the largest tree. A fire was blazing away from inside an old rusty barrel. The seniors and the 2 other freshmen, Phoebe and Terrence, were already gathered and standing about. When they saw me, Ruby Fraser sneered. She was the senior who tagged Phoebe. "You're late." I jogged over to them, breathlessly offering a quick apology and turning off the headlamp. Justin was leaning back against the green hatchback, sipping from a ginger ale and spinning a twig between his fingers like a drumstick. He dipped his head at me in impassive acknowledgement. I felt my cheeks warm. "Now that we're all here," Vince Graysmith, the senior who tagged Terrence, said. He swung the backpack from his shoulders onto the dusty ground. "We can begin, Justin. Want to finish that and join me?" Wordlessly, Justin poured out the rest of his drink and tossed the can onto the front seat. "Okay," said Vince. He turned his attention to us freshmen. "You guys have everything on your lists?" We all nodded with murmurs to the affirmative. "Hey," Ruby asked, squinting at me, "why aren't you wearing red?" I felt myself pale. I tugged at my hoodie, looking at it closely. I am wearing red. "Dude," Ruby said, "that is orange." Well, I took a moment to stare at my hoodie. Yeah, Justin said, grabbing my arm and pulling me closer to the light of the barrel fire. That's orange. My cousin gave it to me to wear. Mary? She's fucking with you, chick, Ruby told me with a smirk. That is orange. Why do we even need red? Terrence asked, looking at his football jersey. Ruby let out a frustrated and disgusted sigh. Because it's the color of courage. It's good luck. And blood, added Justin with a devilish grin. Don't forget about blood. You wear red. Vin spoke loudly to drown out the reply Ruby seemed to have been gathering. Because that's how it's done. Now, can we begin? I have to be at work early tomorrow, and I don't want this to take all night. We all nodded. All right, he said, and reached into his pocket, producing three Sharpies. On the red ribbon, write the name of someone you've wronged. I reached into my pocket and pulled out the red ribbon. Vince handed me a Sharpie, and I pushed the tip to the silk. With a heavy feeling in my gut, I wrote Adam. Now, on the doll, write the name of someone or something you've lost. I reached into my pocket again and pulled out a small stuffed clown with a ceramic face. Grandmother had given it to me years ago, but it kind of creeped me out, so I felt no qualms about getting rid of it. Again, I wrote Adam's name. I didn't know we'd be writing on them, Terrence said, holding a Barbie dress in a big poofy pink ball gown. I mean, this is my little sister's. I just borrowed it from her. Either Princess Fluffy butt goes in, or you don't, Ruby said. That's how it is. You need a doll. It's tribute. Terrence stared at the doll in his hands for a long moment before turning the dress up and writing something on the Barbie's back. Phoebe was holding a porcelain china doll, dressed in green overalls and bright yellow buttons. Its bright white face was haloed by neat strands of corn-colored hair and hollow blue eyes that stared out into nothing. Across its face she wrote, Love. That's a nice doll, I said. You're okay getting rid of it? Phoebe shifted the doll under her arm and capping a Sharpie. Not at all. This thing is evil. It belongs here. I really didn't have a reply. Now, you each have your pages from the Castle of Otranto? It took me a second to find my page. It had gotten tucked far down into my back pocket. Now, on the back of this page, write down something you wish for. Winning the lottery, passing chemistry, getting into a good college. Getting lucky with a crush, Ruby added, with a saucy wiggle of her hips. Just write down what you wish for, said Vince, okay? Try to keep it in the realm of possibility, added Justin. Increases the chance it'll come true. Despite the absurdity of what I was hearing, I eagerly wrote, I wish Justin Thorpe would go out with me. As I put my note away, I hope Justin didn't notice how red my face felt. Now you guys have your quarters and chalks, right? We all pulled out our chalk sticks and quarters. My chalk stick had broken in two inside of my pocket and colored the insides white. Okay, now we can get to the meat of why we're here tonight. Vince reached down into his backpack and pulled out a small black book. It was a dusty old thing. The pages were stained with age, and the spine was coming loose. This is the Abernathy Tome. It's been passed down to our peers since the founding of this company. All who attempt Holly House have recorded their names inside. Tonight, as you make your own attempt, your names will become a part of its pages as well. He turned the book to us and opened it to a seemingly random spot. The margins and any white spaces at all were covered in names. Hundreds. "That's a Bible," Terrence said. "You shouldn't write in a Bible." The three seniors all exchanged knowing looks. "This will be explained. Is the Abernathy Family Bible. The Abernathys were the last folks to inhabit Holly House, and the bulk reason for its infamy," Justin continued. "Their names are the first in the book." Vince opened to the first page, revealing the faded ink. There was a tree drawn on the page, with names written into the branches. Each of the names had been scratched out. However, the ink was well aged as well. Whoever crossed off the names did it a long time ago. "Robert Nathan Bradford built this mansion for his wife in 1802. Vince began, his tone giving the impression of a well-rehearsed performance. "They were a young, wealthy couple from upstate New York who moved here to start a family and profit from the growing timber industry. After years of trying, they finally conceived a child, a baby girl named Holly. However, when Holly was 9 years old, tragedy struck. She slipped and fell into the garden fountain where she drowned. Struck with unbearable grief, Robert's wife drank cyanide and died in her husband's arms. Lost without his two great loves, Robert hung himself in the parlor the night after his wife was laid to rest. The mansion fell silent for 20 years until an industrialist named Gregory Abernathy bought the estate in 1835. By all accounts, Ruby picked up and continued on in the same tone, Gregory Abernathy was a hard man who held more love and devotion for money and business than his family. He had a wife named Tabitha who gave him 3 sons, William, Samuel, and Elias. Their family was rich and the envy of the town, but outward appearances were just an illusion, masking the profound horrors that were to come. When Elias contracted yellow fever at the age of 12 and passed away, Gregory Abernathy began to drink heavily. He became cruel and despondent. In a drunken rage, he pushed his second son Samuel through the cellar door and down the stairs to his death. When the Civil War broke out some years later, William went to join the Union Army against his father's wishes. Abernathy told William that he could never return home unless he came back a decorated war hero. William fell at Gettysburg and came home in a box with a post-mortem rank of colonel. With her 3 sons dead, continued Justin, and her husband as distant as ever, Tabitha became a shamble of a woman. With little left to find solace in from her husband's malice, she began to seek her companionship in other men. One day, Gregory came home to find another man in his bed with Tabitha. An insatiable rage overtook him, and he stabbed Tabitha to death in their bed with his pocket knife. The man fled the room, but Abernathy gave chase. He pushed the man down the stairs, and where he died at the bottom steps, his skull cracked open. Upon seeing what he had done and all his family now dead, Gregory Abernathy went stark raving mad. He gathered all his terrified servants and locked them in the barn before setting it on fire. A maid from the kitchen escaped and ran to town to tell of all she had seen. When the sheriff arrived, the barn was but a smoldering ash pile. Gregory Abernathy sat at the steps of his grand house with a pistol, and as the sheriff approached, Abernathy laid his lips around the barrel and fired. Vince picked up the storyline from there. It is said that the house itself is sick with death and that all that go inside will be infected with it. Your objective tonight is to brave the house of death and come out untouched. Despite being born and raised in this town, I never heard any of this, except the name Abernathy. There was a mining company based in town named Abernathy Coal, but nothing else rang a bell. Your first task is to climb the oak tree into the master bedroom where Tabitha died. Ruby continued, gesturing to the large oak we stood under. I jumped when she spoke. She was standing really close to my side, and I hadn't been paying him much attention to her. Once inside, take your red ribbon and tie it to the bedpost. From the bedroom, you need to cross the corridor to the nursery, but you have to make it in 9 steps, said Justin, and then added with another one of his grins, any more than that, and you'll wake the dead. In the nursery, leave the doll, Vince said. From there, you'll descend down the main staircase. But beware, said Ruby. You have to make it to the bottom without stepping on the 3rd or last 2 steps. The parlor will be on your left. Take your chalk and walk to the center of the room. Close your eyes and point ahead of you like this. Vince raised his arm straight ahead of him, with his finger pointed forward. Spin around a few times, and wherever you stop, that's where you write your greatest fear down. The whole place is either wood or brick or plaster, so any place is good. Why? Terence asked. Phoebe and I turned to him and made harsh, shushing noises. The parlor leads to a butler's pantry that goes into the kitchen. In there on a counter, you'll find some salt. Take a pinch and throw it over your left shoulder. It'll help make sure any spirits that you've managed to piss off goes away, Ruby added. If you do it right, there's no worry. This is to make sure the idiots who can't follow directions don't ruin it for everyone. We don't need anyone taking a ghost home with them. They stay here. How does throwing salt help? I asked, feeling a little lost. Salt purifies, Justin said. It's also for good luck. Oh. Finally, you make your way down into the cellar. At the bottom, you'll see huge cracks in the walls. Roll your wish up and tuck it into a crack. Once you do that, it's up through the other cellar door into the back garden. Toss your quarter into the fountain. Thank your lucky stars. And meet us all back here for snacks. And since you are late, Ruby said to me, with a toothy grin and opening the Abernathy Bible in front of me, a pen sitting neatly atop its pages, you can go first. I reached out and picked up the pen. I scanned the page, looking for a space. I found one at the top of the page and laid pen to paper and paused. Right next to where I was about to sign my name was the name of my late brother, Adam. I quickly signed the page and turned to face Holly House with a renewed sense of vigor. After hearing Justin, Ruby, and Vince go through the origins of Holly House, the murders and death that occurred, and the treacherous tasks I would face within, I did not think climbing the tree would be as hard as it was. I got stuck. Justin had to climb up and untangle my hoodie and hair from the branches. I also learned out of slight fear of heights, and scraped my knee. Lucky, lucky me. The largest branch of the oak tree stretched all the way out to where the master bedroom window opened up onto a small decorative landing. As I stepped down from the tree, I eased my weight down onto the wooden paneling to check and see if it would hold. For looking as ancient as it did, the wood was strong and sure. There came a murmured cheer from below. As I came down, ahead of me lay the death suit of Mrs. Tabitha Abernathy. The window was a large black square that sat before me, seemingly void of color or light. The glass had been removed long ago, and I could still see the scuff markings of sneakers against the edge from kids before me. I eased myself through the window and hopped down into the master bedroom. My feet made an odd crunching noise against the door. The clouds parted and the room filled with moonlight. There was glass everywhere, little shards of it sprinkled between the floorboards and making the room dance with sparkles of light as my headlamp's glow passed over them. It was a perfectly square space with plastered walls. Some of it was crumbling, revealing the wooden ribs of Holly House's innards. A pile of wood lay in the corner, little brass knobs hanging from a few of the panels, and I supposed it was a set of drawers at one point. To my left were the skeletal remains of a grand four-post bed. At least it used to be grand. The mattress was gone, but all around the posts were various shades of ribbons. Red ribbon. You could barely see the posts anymore. There was so much ribbon. And of all shades of red you could imagine. Bright red, dark red, maroon, and even a red that even matched the orange of my hoodie. I looked about the posts, found a spot with a slightly less accumulation of ribbons, and pulled my own piece around it. As I pulled the knot tight, a low moan disrupted the silence around me. My heart leapt into my trachea. I looked around, but I saw nothing. The wind, I decided. I finished my knot, stood from my crouch, and turned. Just as a tall shadow swept across the room, I screamed and tumbled back into the post, banging my shoulder and falling backwards. I looked up from my place on the floor in time to see the shadow flee through the door towards the nursery. I felt frozen to the floor. I saw legs. It had legs. Shadows don't normally have legs. I didn't want to move. The room was mostly bare and I felt horribly exposed. The desire to go back through the window was immense. And then I heard a giggle from outside the window. And then I felt angry. I was convinced I was being had. None of this was real. I wasn't going to be laughed at. What I just seen, or what I thought I saw, could have easily been a trick of the light or my own shadow. There was so much little flickers of light. Who knows what kind of shadows could manifest in here? So much of it was bouncing all over the place. There was bound to be shadows dancing about. It was probably my own. My cheek flushed with heat. Pulling myself from the dusty floor and checking my hands and butt for glass, I ambled towards the open door. The corridor stretched a good 20 feet between the master and the room at the end of the hallway. I assumed that was the nursery because the other four doors were closed and boarded shut save for one. So I had 9 steps to make it to the nursery. I'm not the tallest person on the planet, and as a general rule, short people have short legs. I figured my best bet was to take leaping jumps. I backed into the room and behind me for a running start and leaped forward. I landed solidly, but the wood beneath me shivered uncertainly, and fearing the floor would give way, I stepped. Fuck. Gathering my wits, I made another quick jump, willing my legs to stretch as far as they would go. My landing did not make the floor shiver this time, so I jumped again and again and again. 3 more leaps, and I was just barely past the halfway mark. I was beginning to feel more pissed off than scared. I'm too short to make it the rest of the way, I said to the house. At this point, I felt utterly ridiculous, so I'm going to walk the rest of the way. I made my short person strides over to the nursery door, pulling the clown doll from my pocket and walked into the room. As I passed under the lintel, there was a sudden series of booms that seemed to be coming up behind me. Boom, boom, boom. I turned around to see an empty hallway. Boom, boom, boom. It seemed to be getting closer. Boom, boom, boom. And just as it seemed to crescendo right in front of me, it stopped. There was sudden and eerie silence. 9 booms for each step I was supposed to take. I felt like I was being scolded by a house. I looked back down the hall and noticed 3 of the 4 doors were boarded shut, but the 4th, the one with the most wall next to it, was not. How easy would it be for someone to be inside that room and, when they heard someone, mistake the 9 steps to make loud boom noises? It would not be that hard by estimation. It made me feel a little better. Having decided I had debunked another spiritual occurrence, I turned to face the nursery. I stared into a room full to the brim with dolls. Rows and rows of dolls of every shape, size, material, and color. All of them were turned to face the door. I was the focus of thousands of big little eyes and blank, soulless faces. The light of my headlamp caught the glass of the porcelain doll eyes, giving them an unsettling appearance as though they were really looking at me. They seemed to be expecting something of me, and remembering my own creepy doll, I stepped forward and sat the clown doll next to a dusty troll doll with neon pink hair. It was the least freaky looking. And then I noticed something in the corner of my eye, a pink stuffed elephant that struck at my memory like a bell. I felt a kind of pull and found myself stepping over other dolls and reaching out to deftly pluck the dusty toy from the shelf, the well-worn tag sticking out front behind its tail. Had a name written on it. A child's name. My name. Written with black Sharpie across its belly and familiar slanted lettering were two simple words. My sister's trust. I felt the tears flood my eyes. This was Adam's elephant. Well, it was actually my elephant that he took, but still, I ran my fingers across the matted fur and imagined Adam holding it in his hands, writing his message on it and desperately wishing I knew what he had been thinking or feeling when he did it. I was overwhelmed with the familiar feeling of wanting to tell him it was okay. I wasn't mad at him anymore. I forgave him long ago, even before. I was just too stubborn to be the first one to say I'm sorry. I pressed the dirty thing to my face, wishing I could smell that overpowering body spray he liked so much through the toy, and stretching my imagination. I almost could. Wiping my tears, I stuffed the pink elephant into the pocket of my hoodie and left the doll room. I had some stairs to tame. Unlike the floors in the rest of the house so far, the stairs were covered with a faded and tattered gray material that may have at one point been velvet. The rules of the stairs were that I had to skip the third step down and then the last two. Simple enough. I stepped over the third stair and ambled down the rest until I got to the last two. I looked at them, wondering what would happen if I stepped on them. Finding Adam's elephant had left me filled with a kind of arrogant confidence. Nothing could touch me. So I leaped over the second to the last step, landing firmly atop the very last stair. The upstairs began to shudder, and I heard the booms again, more rapidly than before. Dust and grit rained down from the ceiling, and I clapped my hand over my ears until it stopped. This ghost seemed to be a one-trick pony. "Is that it?" I asked. At first, nothing happened, and I honestly began to feel a little gypped. But as I stepped off the last stair, a low murmuring came from up the stairs that grew steadily louder. I turned to look and found myself staring at the same black shadowy mass I had seen previously. From atop the stairs it loomed, a vague head-like mass turning to look down at me without eyes. The low murmur grew louder until I could discern a person's voice, and it grew. The shadow descended the stairs. The louder the voice got, the faster the shadow moved. Oh no. Unthinking, I stepped back until my shoulder slammed into the wall and the shadow flew at me. It was a mere breath away. I shut my eyes and felt a frigid wind slap into me, taking away my breath, and a pain sparked behind my eyes. I fell to the floor trembling, holding my head and openly weeping. After several horrible moments, I peeked through the gaps in my fingers. The shadow sat squared in the middle of the room, floating there like a viscous glob of black nothing. The pounding of my heart was all I could hear. I remember unconsciously gripping the elephant in my pocket. A spindle piece of the shadow split from the main mass an arm. It seemed to be waving at me or beckoning me. My first thought was a resounding, oh, hell no. But I thought this, an audible voice so close to my ear, I could feel the heat from its breath say, finish the game. I started and whipped my head around. There was no one there. But I had heard a voice, a young girl's voice, so clearly say it to me. I couldn't decide what I disliked more, the shadow or the voice. Looking back towards the parlor, the shadow was gone. Feeling my chance had presented itself, I got up and turned towards the front door. We haven't finished yet, said the voice. The same voice. I slapped a hand over my ear, adamant that I had felt the breath of her words against my flesh. I paused, mind racing. Finally, I asked, if I finish the game, will you leave me alone? A single crystal clear note of a piano rang out from the parlor. Deciding I had my answer, and with more stubbornness than courage, made my way into the parlor. A large dusty carpet lay in shreds upon the floor next to the remnants of a piano. The hood lay open, and its string guts lay in pieces inside. How can a piano play with its chords snapped? The walls were covered in flecks of white chalk. Writing, most of it, was done in small writing, but some of the larger texts I could make out, the things that other kids feared. Disappointing my parents, being poor, not getting into Yale, getting fat, AIDS, my stepdad, death. I pulled a chalk out of my pocket and closed my eyes. I only spun once, not trusting anything to be sturdy enough should I trip and fall. I would like to leave this house ghost-free and not impaled by giant wooden splinters. I opened my eyes and found my hands pointing to a bookshelf. Most of the books were long gone, but there were a few tattered tomes scattered about in various degrees of decay. I walked up to the shelves, reading much of the same kinds of fears written there too. I had entered the house with a vague idea of what to write, but I decided I had a new fear. In between pregnant and being a loser, I wrote my message, ghosts. I waited after writing it, expecting the shadow or the voice to return, but there was nothing. I took a long, steady breath, wiped away the moisture gathering at my eyes, and headed for the kitchen. I was in need of some salt. The kitchen was an oddly shaped room. It was long and thin, with a large fireplace dominating one wall and counters along the other. A long work table split the room down the middle. Sitting as innocent as can be on the top, the table was a canister of Morton salt. With a kind of manic relief, I reached for it and opened the tab. I poured a heaping pile of it into my palm with the excess spilling off the sides of my hands and onto the floor. That's wasteful, said the voice. I hurled the fistful of sand over my shoulder, hoping it would strike the damn thrice voice right in its ghost eye. Instead, a howl of pain. I got a giggle. Wrong shoulder. I poured another handful, split it between each palm, and threw them both over my shoulders, just for good measure. The voice was silent. I poured a third handful and turned to the cellar door. There were no windows to help light the cellar up like the rest of the house. No moonlight reached down there. I turned my headlamp to high, one hand gripping my salt and the other holding a firm grip on my elephant. With only the narrow pathway of light to guide me down, I took the first step. The cellar smelled of stagnant water and mold. Even before I got to the bottom step, I could see the large cracks in the walls. Little round paper tubes were stuffed firmly in every one of them. Aging paper bits were pressed into every space. I had to start on one wall and edge over to the others, scanning the wall for a spot that had an opening. I stood in front of the wall under the stair. The before I found a small sliver of space. With my free hand, I pulled my wish paper from my pocket, carefully rolled it into a tube, and slipped it into the crack. I got up from my crouched position and turned. A little girl stood where there should have been no one. I was too shocked to be scared at first. I thought she was a kid like me, trying to be brave in the haunted house. "You shouldn't be down here," I blurted. "It's dangerous." The girl just stared at me, and I felt the first stirrings of unease. She stared at me without saying anything, looking between my face and my pocket. I began to notice she wasn't dressed like a normal kid. She was dressed kind of fancy, like she was going to a party. "You can't take it," she said. Upon hearing her speak, I knew exactly who she was. "Take what?" I asked the voice now with visible form. "The pink elephant?" I reached into my pocket, gripping the toy. "Why?" I asked. "It's mine," she said. "Adam gave it to me." I felt sick. The room seemed to spin, getting smaller and smaller. The air seemed too thin. I couldn't breathe. "It wasn't Adam's to give," I said, with real fear cracking my voice. "He took it from me without permission." "It's mine," she said, little arm raised expectantly. She took a step forward and I took one back. "Give it back." "Please," I begged her. "You have so many toys. I don't have anything left of him. There's only this. I don't care. Please. I want it. I want it too." "You can't." She was so close now, almost touching me. I threw the salt in a line at my feet, and the girl froze, just beyond the line's boundary. Suddenly, inspiration struck, and I turned back to the wall to find my paper. "Fine," I said. "How about this?" I pulled it out, grabbed a Sharpie from my pocket, and scratched out my previous wish. In its place, I scribbled, "I wish to keep the pink elephant." Looking over my shoulder, I saw the girl standing there, arms at her side and seeming to be waiting for something. "Oh," I said, and rolled up my paper and shoved it into the crack. When I turned back around, the girl was gone. Scrambling back to my feet, I made my way to the glowing outline of the door leading to the back garden. Old warped metal creaked as I pushed the storm doors apart and was met with blissfully cool and sweet air. I let the metal door slam behind me and was about to walk around the house when I remembered the quarter. The pool was a large circular stone piece set among the overgrown weeds and vines that had overtaken most of the space. When I was close enough, I tossed the quarter into the glimmering water and not wanting to risk seeing something in the glimmering surface. When I made it back to the campfire, Phoebe and Terrence were pale and looking at me like I was something horrifying. "What was all that screaming?" Phoebe asked. "I heard screaming." "Oh," I said, feeling suddenly gun-shy. Should I say anything? "I tripped a couple of times and I saw a rat." I couldn't seem to find the words to say what had happened. Phoebe made strange eating sounds at the words rat. Terrence looked relieved. I'm not sure why I was lying to them about what I saw, or that I saw anything at all. Terrence was next to enter. Maybe they wouldn't see anything. While Ruby and Vince helped Terrence get up the tree, Johnston took me aside to the back of his green hatchback and gave me a lukewarm ginger ale. "It helps with stomach queasiness," he said. "You look like you need it." I took it graciously and sipped at it, letting the carbonation burn the back of my throat. My mind seemed to race, and I found myself purposely looking away from the house. "You didn't follow the rules, did you?" Justin asked with a knowing smirk. "Took too many steps?" After a moment, I nodded. "The booms gave you a scare?" he asked, again with that same Cheshire grin. I just looked at him. "Don't worry about it," he said. He leaned in close to my ear. "It's just Kyle making noise. Everyone missteps the quarter. Don't tell Ruby or Vince I ruined the magic. You just look like you're ready to puke. And the stairs? I ask, feeling a strange combination of embarrassment, rage, and disbelief. Was that him too? Yeah, just him jumping around. And the shadow? Justin gave me a look. What shadow? Never mind, I said quickly. I took a long swig of the warm soda. My insides felt heavy. What about the little girl? I asked finally. A small bit of me hoping, but somehow I knew the answer. I squeezed my pink elephant as Justin gave me the same strange look. What girl? I glanced towards the house, somehow expecting to see the girl standing in one of the windows or something to reaffirm my fears, but they remained dark and specterless. I'm still not sure if I feel relieved or disappointed about that. I sighed deeply, feeling in need of a long, hot shower and perhaps an absurdly large portion of ice cream. I was still debating whether to go into full detail about what happened in the cellar when we heard the first of Terrence's screams. How big are the rats in that place? Phoebe shrieked. A smile tugged at the corners of my mouth. Beside me, Justin let out a hearty belly laugh. After he caught his breath, he turned to me, a slight redness to his cheeks. So, you know, I was thinking, would like to, I don't know. Would you like to go out sometime? Maybe?